this talk event, this series, and yes, it will be more than one, but you know me and series, I just follow my nose, so I'm not going to make any predictions. I'm just going to start, and then we'll stop when it's over. I hope you are not tired of me talking about my mom yet, because I'm not done doing it. If you are tired of it, I hope you'll be so kind as to just indulge me when I do. It occurred to me when I was kind of putting this together and thinking about some of the stories that I wanted to tell, and you know, one in particular about my mom, that one of my performer friends likes to say that when they sing and talk about the things that they're thinking about and writing music about, that's how they process things. That's their therapy. And so if people will pay to be in the room, you know, while they do this therapeutic thing, that sounds like a win-win to them, you know, like, so thanks for showing up for my therapy. And sometimes in little ways, in some ways, telling stories about my mom in the context of this community feels a bit like that. And therapy might be a strong and misplaced word for it technically, but process certainly isn't. And so I feel really grateful to be received as a person with a whole story, you know, including that. So thank you. And in particular, in the context of this series, which is about the pursuit of happiness, you know, many of you, that in my life experience, my mom remains an outstanding example of what it looks like to choose happiness. And so since we're sort of starting into this subject, the odds are at least fair that she's going to come up once in a while. I don't think I fully realized how funny my mom was until the last couple of years of her life. I mean, I think my mom, you know, took the business of her role in life and family and community seriously, and there was lots to be done. And so I feel like my primary experiences of my mom were of her really kind of focused on getting it done, you know, and there wasn't a lot of just sort of, you know, sitting around and talking that was happening. And then, of course, in the later years of her life, there was more of that. But she was really funny. And not necessarily in a belly laugh kind of way, but in a low-key wit sort of way. Like, she'd just sort of have these one-liners that were parked in the wings waiting for their moment. And she had a pretty good sense of comic timing as well. One of my favorite stories that illustrates this is about how when she was a little kid, before her dad was crippled by MS, he worked as a logger, and so they lived in logging camps in the winter, because in Saskatchewan, where she grew up, that winter was when logging happened, because you could get around on the wet ground. And the accommodations were pretty basic. There were these uninsulated sort of clapboard buildings for the most part, and wood stoves for heat. And that worked okay in the daytime when people were around to kind of keep feeding the logs in, and there was lots of logs. You know, but at night, sometimes it got pretty chilly. And she liked to tell a story about how you'd wake up in the morning and your blankets would be frozen to the wall, right? And then she'd kind of have this little beat, you know, this little pause, a little kind of sideways smile, and she'd say, "But it was fresh." That was more my mom's kind of jam when it came to humor. And the thing is, she wasn't being disingenuous when she made her observation about it being fresh. She was just choosing to see what was good about the situation. And as I've sort of thought about her commitment to that value, you know, but it was fresh, I've realized that in part that was deeply informed by her father's subsequent battle with tuberculosis, the recovery from which required air that was fresh. So there's a bunch of layers, right, to that observation, for sure. We'll talk about this more as we go, but I wanted to start with that story because for me it illustrates, among other things, how complex choosing happiness can be. And that's important to me as an idea, but it's also important to me personally because I wouldn't self-describe happy as my default setting as a personality. I don't think I'm dour or negative, at least not most of the time. You can ask Corrine if you want a different perspective on all this. But I don't think that people that meet me for the first time would necessarily walk away going, Now there is a happy guy. Like, I just, you know, at least not if their idea of happy was sort of equated with bubbly and effervescent and outgoing. So as I said in the blurb, in some ways, this is me talking to myself about happiness. So, you know, thanks for dropping by and listening in. I think it might be important to address some objections to the whole subject right out of the gate. Not everybody thinks that the pursuit of happiness is a good idea, and not everyone who thinks that it is a good idea believes it is possible to attain. So let's talk about some of the problems with all of this at a kind of overall level, and then as we go along, we can get into the challenges that might come if we decide to look into it from a more positive or more of a what might be possible here kind of a perspective. So objections first. These are in no particular order and not exhaustive, but I think they're pretty representative. So problem number one, happy people can be really annoying. So my question is this a universal truth or is it highly circumstantial? So for instance, is this truer in the morning than it is in the evening? For instance, my childhood recollections of morning are that my dad was out the door to work first thing. My mom, who was someone who thought that it was a good idea to, you know, in her phrase, to get up with the chickens. You ever been on the farm? Like, those damn chickens don't care if you want to sleep in, and they don't know how to sleep in. So getting up with the chickens, that's a sunrise-y kind of thing. And so mom thought that was a good way to start the day. And so she'd be up, my bedroom's downstairs, she'd be upstairs kind of rummaging around, doing what she did in the morning, and she'd call down the stairs, and it was pretty consistent. The phrase was pretty consistent. She'd say, "Rise and shine!" Rise and shine? Like, you know, seriously? Seriously, Mom? I saw a greeting card a couple of days ago that had this picture of a kid on it, and this kid had great hair, like just a massively thick, completely frazzled head of hair going on, and had a laptop under their arm and this gigantic mug that just said coffee across the front, and they were just kind of taking this, you know, can I find the cup kind of sip from it, and the front cover text said simply, "First coffee," and then when you opened it, it said, "Then get on with changing the world." Not everybody finds people that are happy first thing in the morning positively motivating. This is just true, and while it might not be universal, it's certainly not new. There's a Hebrew proverb, probably rough shot here, probably about 2,500 years old, that says a loud and cheerful greeting early in the morning will be taken as a curse. Not even maybe taken as a curse. Just like flat out, you're gonna get a negative response if you do that. Well, that's fair. I think that's fair. So maybe we could observe, as a general rule, when we're talking about happiness, that happiness is okay, but the volume and the timing of it matter. So there's some nuance. It's not just all good. So then there's problem number two, maybe a little weightier, which we might generally describe as guilt. Not specific, personal, I shouldn't have done that sort of guilt. More like a sort of a hazy, ubiquitous, hard to pin down kind of guilt. The kind of guilt that comes from being aware, even a little bit, of the deep sorrow, chaos, and injustice of the world. Personally, I'm more likely to get hung up here than I am to snap at a chirpy morning person, because the same mother who taught me to rise and shine taught me to be polite. So even if inside I'm like, are you seriously going to be that chirpy in the morning? I'm more likely to kind of mutter good morning or something, semi-civil, right? But this one I could get stuck on. Because really, how can one pursue happiness with a clear conscience when just steps away there's a person suffering from the brutal impacts of systemic injustice, or there's a newscast that reminds us of how many millions lost their homes in a flood today or have been displaced by war or starving or? Isn't it either a symptom of blind self-absorption, callous indifference, or willful ignorance to pursue happiness in the face of other people's pain? And just to keep the tension in this sort of consideration alive and well, we might ask, if we take that idea to heart, we might then ask what mode of existence is acceptable in light of those kinds of considerations. Maybe perpetual indignation, especially with those that seem happy, or maybe some degree of sympathetic depression, sort of a low-grade sadness that lets everybody know that we're aware of suffering and we want to do our part to alleviate it, and if we can't do that, we will at least try to share in it somehow. It's what my grandfather would have called a sticky wicket. If you don't know what that is, you can look it up and then muse about why my prairie grandfather even knew that saying. All right. Problem number three. We're not solving these, as you may have noticed. Problem number three. You might have some vague sense, quite possibly rooted in the religious training of your past, if that's part of your past, or maybe in your present, that it's, I'm going to use some stereotypical religious language here, so just FYI, you might have this vague sense that it is too worldly to be happy. I grew up in a family where my dad was only one generation removed from what he called Old Colony Mennonites. These were folks that came to Canada complete with cultural and religious values about worldliness, among other things, that expressed themselves in some pretty radical ways. No cars, wearing all black, head coverings for the women, no zippers. Did you know that zippers are worldly? I'm still puzzling on this, but I'm wondering if it has something to do with, like, I don't know, spontaneous intimacy or something. But anyway. And unapologetic patriarchy. Structurally, those are all, you know, kind of things that were real in that world. So in that cultural framework, being in the world but not of it, which is a biblical text, was taken quite literally, pretty seriously. It had some pretty pragmatic expressions. The pursuit of happiness in a context like that can kind of look like the opposite of, I don't know, the opposite of what? Well, let's say the pursuit of holiness, since that's the language we're using. As a general religious concept, holiness could be defined as exalted or worthy of complete devotion as one perfect in goodness and righteousness. Woohoo! Perfect in goodness and righteousness. Huh? Somehow, happiness got to be an obstacle on the way to holiness, and some of us got the message that you can be in pursuit of goodness or you can be in pursuit of happiness, but you can't be both. So if you're serious about righteousness, you better say goodbye to happiness, and vice versa. It does shed a little bit of light on the idea that it's hard to be happy without being naughty, though, doesn't it? Like, you see how those pieces fit together? And it makes me want to spend a good bit of time pondering how happiness ended up being something other than good. Because that's an interesting problem in itself. And I should mention, in this context, that some of us along the way probably heard from a preacher somewhere that there is an important difference between happiness and joy. Anybody heard this particular sermon? Judy's nodding a few heads. Yeah, okay. And you could do some kind of linguistic gymnastics that make joy seem okay, but happiness seem like something that's sort of shallow and trivial and ephemeral, right? We might come back to this, but if I'm going to stay in the context for a moment, I'm going to apply some sort of classical biblical scholarship to that problem. If I did that, we could observe in that framework that the Greek word, I told you I was going to do this, that the Greek word that Jesus uses when he reels off those greatest hits in Matthew, you know, the Beatitudes, blessed are, those ones. So he reels all those off. And then he has this grocery list of things that don't sound all that great that follow the blessed are's. Well, the word that often gets translated blessed in that context is the exact same Greek word that would be accurately translated as happy or lucky. It's the same word. And the way Jesus uses it in the Sermon on the Mount is just that way. He says that people that are poor in spirit, that mourn, that are meek, who really, really want to be good, who are merciful, who are pure-hearted, who are peacemakers, who get put down by other people, who get insulted, who get falsely accused, those folks, the rabbi says, are just plain old happy, lucky, satisfied, blessed. I said we weren't going to solve them, right? All to say this, if you heard a preacher make a distinction between happy and joyful, the preacher gets to go for it, of course, but they might want to acknowledge that this particular batch of texts is going to be problematic when it comes to making that argument. Okay, problem number four. You are somebody who just arrived in the world as a natural-born cynic, and to you, happiness looks like an illusion. You're inclined to the philosophical. You're more prone to pronouncements like, life is pain. It's not that hard for you to find reinforcement for your point of view, is it? Just when the philosophical you was getting weary of the tedium of compiling the evidence in support of your claim that life is pain, Along came a global event that ended millions of lives and disrupted millions more livelihoods, not to mention accelerating and deepening divisions in an already polarized culture. You need an easy-to-see, hard-to-ignore example of how life is suffering? Watch the news. And when you do the math, from that vantage point, happiness in this world looks like an abnormality, maybe even a defect. If people were really honest about the circumstances, truly acknowledging the way things are, they would be knowing, they would be tragic, they would be cynical. And from this kind of perspective, we might say to someone that's happy, if you insist on being happy, I insist that your happiness is either unrealistic ignorance or that you are being insincere and performative, probably for some self-serving reason. Why you would bother is beyond me, but I suspect it benefits you in some way because it's sure not facing reality head on. So for that person, from that perspective, whatever happiness claims to be, you know you don't believe in it. So that's a bunch of example problems. We could even call them reasons to be dismissive about the pursuit of happiness. Like I said at the outset, it's not an exhaustive list. You quite possibly have your own reasons to not lean into this. I would be remiss, I think, if I didn't acknowledge that for some of us, pursuing happiness might be very desirable and simply feel impossible for reasons that have to do with our mental health, and those reasons can be as concrete in our experience as a desire to run might be alive and well in us, and an injured leg keeps us from doing it. So there's that as well. One of my goals in this series is to keep that sort of complexity in view by offering a perspective on happiness that is nuanced enough to keep us clear of the toxic version of this. Because there is a thing that I think we could fairly simply describe as toxic happiness. And also to keep the idea of the pursuit of happiness invitational to all of us, including those of us for whom it's just categorically a difficult idea. And next week we'll take a look at some considerations, sort of from the other side, if you will, reasons why taking the pursuit of happiness quite seriously, and it's not an oxymoron, actually, to say that it needs to be taken seriously, but that's worth a second look. So as with everything that has to do with a talky bit in this context, my goal is not to convince you of a particular perspective as much as to offer catalytic things to explore. So we'll kind of come from that other side. In the course of my own reading and thinking about this, I ran across a quote, brace yourself, because here he is again, from Wendell Berry. I'm binging. The quote said this: "Be joyful, though you have considered all the facts." Yeah, that pulls it together the way a good poet does, right? You know, that's pretty tight, and also lots of room in it. And when I dug a little deeper, I learned that, no surprise, the quote itself is from a poem of Berry's. In this particular instance, it's a bit of an off-the-wall piece called Manifest, the Mad Farmers Liberation Front. And whether you read Mad in that title, this is indicative of the way the whole poem behaves, whether you read Mad in that title as crazed or crazy or angry is an open question. By the time you get to the end of the poem, the question doesn't get closed. So just so you know that. The poem, I would say, is both sincere and quite tongue-in-cheek. You have to kind of decide as you go through which way a particular line reads for you. This is a lot of preamble for a poem, but I'm going to read us the whole poem. So, you know, just so you know. That's what I'm going to leave us with today, and I'm going to do that because I think it's a pretty fascinating example of one person's perspective of what doing the work of both seeing the facts clearly and at the same time choosing the pursuit of happiness might look like. And so it's both kind of a, it sort of addresses itself to some of the ideology or theory or concepts about this, if you will, and also says some really pragmatic things from Berry's own life practice about what this looks like in their life. And not surprisingly, it looks a bit like farming, it looks a bit like activism, it looks a bit like mysticism, it looks a lot like love, kind of all rolled up together. Worth mentioning before I read the poem, a few details that are worth keeping in mind, because poets are not poets are not just a category, right? They're actually individuals as well. They have a context and a story. And this particular poet, Barry, is writing as a straight person who identifies as male. And so that vantage point might require some translating into other realities. The poem was originally set in a collection of poems that were about being married, which is kind of an interesting context. Also, Barry, and this shows up in the poem in some particular ways, is an American of European descent. They are a committed environmental activist. They are a person who was not abashed about the fact that their spirituality was Christian. And there's the historic fact that this was written in the early 1970s. All of those things sort of show up in language particularities in the poem. Sorry, Rosa. All right, so here we go. We're going to leave us with this and Rosa's. Rosa doesn't need to pursue happiness. She's found it. So we should just go follow Rosa and do what she does, and we'd be fine, right?
Not one tip to grow.
It's complex. So now we have that as well, don't we? Yeah. We can just watch Rosa and make notes. All right. Manifesto of the Mad Farmer Liberation Front. Love the quick profit, the annual raise, vacation with pay. Want more of everything ready made. Be afraid to know your neighbors and to die. And you will have a window in your head. Not even your future will be a mystery anymore. Your mind will be punched in a card and shut away in a little drawer. When they want you to buy something, they will call you. When they want you to die for profit, they will let you know. So, friends, every day, do something that won't compute. Love the Lord, love the world, work for nothing. Take all that you have and be poor. Love someone who does not deserve it. Denounce the government and embrace the flag. Hope to live in that free republic for which it stands. Give your approval to all you cannot understand. Praise ignorance, for what man has not encountered, he has not destroyed. Ask the questions that have no answers. Invest in the millennium. Plant sequoias. Which, by the way, brackets, are dying in droves. Side story. It's interesting that he would have chosen that particular indicative symbol from the world around him. Say that your main crop is the forest that you did not plant, that you will not live to harvest. Say that the leaves are harvested when they have rotted into the mold. Call that profit. Prophesy such returns. Put your faith in the 2 inches of hummus that will build under the trees every 1,000 years. Listen to carrion. Put your ear close and hear the faint chattering of the songs that are to come. Expect the end of the world. Laugh. Laughter is immeasurable. Be joyful, though you have considered all the facts. So long as women do not go cheap for power, please women more than men. Ask yourself, will this satisfy a woman satisfied to bear a child? Will this disturb the sleep of a woman near to giving birth? Give your love to the fields. Lie easy in the shade. Rest your head in her lap. Swear allegiance to what is nighest your thoughts. And as the generals and the politicos can predict the motions of your mind, lose it. Leave it as a sign to mark the false trail, the way you didn't go. Be like the fox who makes more tracks than necessary, some in the wrong direction. Practice resurrection. You got to decide which way every line's going to read, don't you? It's a pretty great poem. There's enough there to offend everyone, I think, at some point, and also to challenge anyone that is actually willing to lean into what Barry is suggesting as a response to becoming a peg that fits a prescribed hole in the way that we live our lives. All of our lives, including things like the pursuit of happiness, things like how that fits with what we believe, why we believe it, the way we live it out in the world. All right, we're going to leave it there.